Evansville's LST-325 is rearmed and ready for battle, but this time on the Ohio River. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, author Chris Underwood takes the reader on board for a wild ride in his book series, The Cold Winter. It's a chaotic time when the power grid is down, nothing works, cars are stranded in the snow on the interstates, people are getting desperate for food and fuel. And to make matters even worse, there's a government takeover. A deadly virus and a foreign power seizes the locks and dams as patriots answer the call to rescue democracy. Ordinary folks perform extraordinary deeds during this cold winter. 2 Main Street with author Chris Underwood is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger, Kim Wren, and the Berger Wealth Services team at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. And welcome aboard for an action-packed adventure featuring Evansville's own LST-325, rearmed and ready for battle on the Ohio River. The Cold Winter is a three-book series by author Chris Underwood, who released the book three on the deck of LST-325, and that was on June 6, 2024, on the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and that was here in Evansville. Yeah. LST-325 is one of the few remaining operational landing ship tanks, and the old warship was in action on D-Day along the Normandy coast in World War II. Now, in the book, LST-325 is called back into service on another mission to save democracy, this time here at home. There is government corruption, misinformation, and a deal to sell a large chunk of America's heartland to the Chinese. Wow. The action begins in the cold winter when the power goes out and all hell breaks loose. Author Chris Underwood is here to tell us all about it. Welcome, Chris. Good to have you here in Evansville.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And you live in Ohio, so let's go to the question here. How did you get fired up about writing a book about LST-325, which is docked here in southern Indiana?
My other job is I'm a computer programmer, and I was working here in Evansville for a company, and spent about almost a year here working for that company. And through that time, I learned a lot about the LST, volunteered on it, and it was just, I thought it was just a great direction for my series to go.
What did you do volunteering on the ship?
Just anything that they would let me do, you know, just helping to move things, move tables, just whatever I could do to do some things for them and spend time on the ship.
So you got a chance to meet some of the characters?
Right, right. That was the main thing. That was the main thing I was after. I wanted to be able to talk to people. And so if they had a little project that needed to get done, you know, I just jumped in to help.
Okay. And also, then you spent several days on the ship during a cruise. And where did this cruise go?
On Labor Day weekend this year, it went to Pittsburgh for 5 days and then down to Wheeling for another 5-day weekend and then Marietta for another 5-day weekend.
Did you have your books on board?
I did. And I sold almost 2,000 books through those 3 weeks. It was just a fantastic thing, the support.
Yeah. And I understand while you were on board, you just didn't sell your books. You were actually working.
Yes. They put me to work. I spent some time in the engine room and other things. Also helping to set up the gangplank plank to help people get on board.
And of course the gangplank. That's huge. That's where all the tanks and all the hardware would come aboard, and of course that could land on a beach too. That was its advantage of the LST.
Right. Okay. With their man walking plank was special made for each of their landing spots.
Yeah.
And
okay.
And had to be rebuilt each time they landed.
What kind of crowds did you have?
Oh, there were some days that we had 3,000 people come through in a day. It was crazy in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, they were right there at the football stadium. So there were lots of people that were coming through.
What was the reaction from the folks going on board the ship?
Oh, they were loving the just everything that was there to see. There was lots of people that were talking to the folks, explaining the different sections of the boat.
Mm-hmm. Now, on board the ship, there are a lot of nooks and crannies. I know I've been on board, and the sleeping quarters are very interesting, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yes. And the area that I slept at was right over the transmission of where and it makes a lot of noise, and it changes sounds a lot through the night. So
right.
As the ship is moving, so it was odd.
And you have that kind of that big community bathroom there with all the showers.
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta time it right.
That's right. And the galley, of course, very important. It's a small kitchen, but boy, that place is hopping, isn't it?
Yes. And they had great staff in there, and they served some fantastic meals. I was really impressed with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now in Book 3, LST 325 is rearmed. Patriots are aboard, and the ship is going upriver on a rescue mission. But we go back down to the beginning of the series, the cold winter. At the start of the book, the power grid is down, so nothing seems to work. Food is becoming scarce. I know at the supermarket, it's a wild scene there as people try to gather what they can, and they have to get rid of all the perishable items, don't they, at the grocery store?
Right. At the beginning, they're not really sure how long it's going to last and all that, so the grocery store, they're just giving away all the frozen stuff before it melts onto the floor. And so it's an interesting scene that I have there with that.
And folks, of course, are getting desperate, and there's some activity in the parking lot when people all gather and try to get what they can. Now, there's a prepper named Tom, T-H-O-M. I guess he's in his element because Tom had gone through another power outage, but was he really prepared for this one or not?
No, he was not prepared enough. And in this story, you learn a little bit about being prepared just from learning from his mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did Tom do for a living?
He's also a computer guy just like me.
Oh, there's a lot of
similarities.
There is. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Now, Tom, of course, has these issues. I don't know if you have the kind of issues that Tom has. I hope not.
No.
That's good because Tom was kind of hooked on things. And his wife, Tony... and they have a son. Tell me about Tony and the son in the book.
Yes. Tom and Tony are having some conflicts. There's a little bit of a power struggle in the household. And it creates some conflicts, and it even builds into more as the emergency happens. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, you're learning about their relationship. And then their son, David, who's on the spectrum, who's on the autism spectrum, much like my son. And so it was a cool, it's a cool storyline of being able to have him involved in the whole story.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tom, he's a pretty smart guy. He rallies his neighbors to be prepared for the worst. Some of these people aren't really, they think the power's going to come back on. Mm-hmm. They say, well, it's going to be temporary, but he doesn't think so. He thinks this could be a long run. Now, you talk about the five F's for survival. Food, of course. Firewood, of course, this is the winter time.
That's right. And first aid.
First aid, firearms, and most importantly, friends.
Yes. Friends is the most important one of them all.
Because they got to have your back.
That's right.
Okay. And my guest is Chris Underwood. He's the author of the Cold Winter series. When Evansville's LST 325 is called into action, once again, this time to do battle on the Ohio River. And I thought it was interesting, too, we were talking about the LST, and I said, well, why isn't the Coast Guard involved? Why don't the Coast Guard boats get involved in this?
Well, because there is an issue with computer chips that's going on. And so it's pretty much a thing of having to go old school with machinery that doesn't have those sorts of items.
And this is confined to the Great Lakes area for some reason.
Right. It's uh, I the basis of the story is that the satellites are communicating to some of these electronics.
And also in southern Canada as well?
That's right. The power outage is limited to just the Niagara Falls power grid.
Okay.
The rest of the country still has power. So it is a situation of a disaster happening where aid is needed and it's being slow to get there.
Okay. The protagonist, Tom Vesper, now he wants his home and other homes to become fortresses because these refugees are showing up. The interstate system is a mess. There's a lot of snow out there. It's really a bad winter. The cold winter is, a character in the book. And these stranded vehicles and folks, they run out of gas, they run out of food, and they start walking.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. The winter is really a character in the story. It, people have compared my story to some of the zombie shows that are out there, and it is very similar. But I replaced the zombies with the winter. Mm-hmm. You still die from something from going outside.
Now these folks, Tom and his little group of people, from Galena, Ohio.
That's right.
Your hometown.
That is my hometown.
Work that in there. Tell me about Galena. What's Galena like?
Galena is a small town. It's only about 600 people in the town. And it's got two rivers on each side, and it all kind of comes together, and the town is kind of in the crotch of the two rivers. And there's two bridges there, and it is kind of an isolated area. The escalation of the emergency is a little bit slower for them. Mm-hmm. I'll just put it that way.
And the landscape of actual Galena is in your book too, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, we have there's a river valley and mm-hmm. things like that for it. So yeah, I bring all of that into the story as people are moving around in the area.
Is it a farming community?
Somewhat. It's still kind of a suburb of Columbus.
Okay. All right. We talked about these refugees leaving their stranded vehicles. And now these people, when they go up, Tom and his group, they're well-meaning, and they come across some of these abandoned vehicles, and they might find something in there, might find some food in there. They might find luggage in there that they can use for the fortresses. Right. But also they find some bodies, don't they?
Yes. It kind of brings some reality of the situation into the story, yes.
And there's a child they
That's
find?
That's right, yes. They come across an accident where the driver has died, but there's a baby in the back seat. And it becomes a real moment of, what do you do? Mm-hmm. What do you do with this situation? And they bring the baby home.
And they name the baby Gloria.
Yes, because they don't really have a name. They don't have any identification for the baby. And so that's a kind of a cool banter between them of, what is the name? What should the name be?
Now, Tony, Tom's wife, she takes a liking to the baby, I assume.
Yes.
Seems like it in the book. She said, oh, we have another child now.
Yes.
Now, coming up, more of my conversation with Chris Underwood. He's the author of the Cold Winter series. And we'll talk about his other books as well and his sailing adventures in Key West. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, and we will be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Chris Underwood, author of the Cold Winter book series. Three books set in the Midwest. No Power, Government Takeover, Families Struggling to Survive, Lawlessness, and Cells of Patriots, Determined to Find Out the Truth. And yes, Evansville's own LST 325 is back in battle, this time on the Ohio River. So let's learn more about my guests. Chris, we talked about growing up in Galena, Ohio. When did you decide you wanted to write novels?
Well, I had studied it at Ohio State when I was there back in the 80s. And I really enjoyed the whole idea of writing and all of that, but I ended up going the safe route with my computer degree.
Well, you want a steady paycheck.
That's right. Yes. And I always thought, someday I'll come back to it, after I found my fame and fortune. And it just worked out exactly that way, except for the fame and fortune part.
Now, earlier you had told me that you wrote a book as a child.
Yeah.
And a very interesting title.
Yes, the story of the three-headed snake. And I still have the copy at home. I made a cover out of construction paper and crayons and all of that. But yeah, that was my first story. And I had several stories published in a little newsletter at my elementary school.
Well, what's the story of the three-headed snake? I mean, what happened?
Oh, I wrecked my bicycle and fell to the ground face to face with this three-headed snake.
Was it become a pet then, or was it an evil character?
You know, it's been a long time since I've read
okay,
it.
Okay, all right. Well, keep me in suspense on that one. Okay, now. The Cold Winter, book one, your first book?
Yes, it was my first book that was, and it was released in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
I started it back in 2012, first writing it, and I have 10 complete versions of it on a thumb drive at home somewhere. and I worked on it over and over, and I actually wrote it the first time the first 9 times in first person. And then I went back and rewrote it in third person after a publisher told me that it would be much better that way.
What are those meetings like with publishers? I mean, what do they quiz you about? What do they want?
Oh, it was mainly more of a thing of they were just trying to determine how if I was a good prospect for them, I guess.
Are they trying to look at an audience?
Yes,
obviously?
They were looking at audiences, and actually back in that time frame, you know, zombie stories were much more big. Mm-hmm. And this was not necessarily a genre that they were looking for.
And I thought it was interesting that there's an illness that appears in the book, and it's kind of reminiscent to what happened with COVID-19, but you wrote this before the COVID-19 outbreak.
Yes. I included a virus. It's actually smallpox. A re-release of smallpox, and it's a combination of that and a flu, but it's a man-made virus, and it's supposed to be used as a bioweapon of some sort through the story.
It's very eerie
that
happened.
It was strange that I released that the spring of 2019,
mm-hmm.
And it kind of spooked me a little bit when all that happened.
Now, in the book, there are a lot of references to sailing in the book. This character, Tom Vesper, that's kind of his dream to be sailing in the Caribbean on a catamaran. He goes shopping for boats. Now, you have a lot of experience on charter boats in the Keys, and you worked on one. Is that correct?
Yes. I was first mate with a sailing boat. His name was the No Wake. And actually the captain that I worked for, his name was Randall. So mm-hmm. I use that name in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we would go down there for vacation, we have a timeshare there. We go at least twice a year. And so we would go down there, and whenever I was in town, I would give Randall a call, and he would have me on as his first mate.
Where would you sail to?
Most of the time, we're just going out somewhere so that the passengers could go snorkeling.
Oh, okay.
It was just a...
Was it day trip?
Yeah, just day trips.
Okay, all right. Okay.
Just day trips. We would go out and find an island and snorkel there.
Mm-hmm. And it's, of course, we talked about the dream. It's the dream of one of your characters, Tom Vesper, who's battling addiction as well as these bad actors, to escape to the calm waters of the Caribbean and is that one of your dream, maybe one day to escape to the calm waters of the Caribbean?
It really is. Yes, it is. I was actually boat shopping this summer, mm-hmm. but it's not the right time of the year.
Okay.
Not the right time of the year.
What are you looking for in a boat?
A sailing catamaran is mm-hmm. what I'm mainly looking for. Mm-hmm. But
what does a sailing catamaran go for these days?
It starts around $250.
Wow.
Yeah, and we can... And that's a used one, you know. You can mm-hmm. and you can spend north of $1 million if you really wanted to.
And then you have to spend money to have a place to dock it.
Right. That's where it really comes in. The expense of the docking and and the and also the maintenance. The maintenance, you're looking at it at least 10 to 15% of the value of the boat each year.
Because then you have to take it out of the water.
Right. There's painting. You know, salt water does lots of damage.
Oh, my. Okay. Okay, now back to the cold winter book series. We talked about book one, where we meet some of the main characters and talk about the situation with the power being out and these refugees wandering around, and you don't know who's good and who's evil. The National Guard gets involved. There's talk of a refugee railroad to get these folks out of harm's way. We meet some interesting characters. Dominic, he's the guy on the radio. Tell me about him.
Yeah, he's started as a smaller character, just a person who would analyze the news reports that are coming out and try to read between the lines, throw his conspiracy theory angle on things. And he was also very very loud, very brash. He was very fun.
Mm-hmm. And he has a sidekick?
Yes, his sidekick is Kirksey, his bearded friend. who also resorts to Spanish when he's in an emergency situation.
That's right. I remember that. Now they have an arsenal in their little compound.
Yes. He's the serious prepper of the group, and he comes into play later on with that role.
And we have another character, Father Michael. Kind of the parish priest in that area. And tell me about Father Michael.
Yes, he's really wanting to keep his flock together, try to keep people and help people. And he helps to create this refugee railroad of homes that people can go to and help them to get to their final destination and be able to go to a door and be able to say, you know, so-and-so sent me, and be able to approach your home without having any issues.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. Now, some people would take these refugees in. Others would just fire a warning shot and say, no, I don't want to mess with you.
Right.
We don't want to share our food or our firewood.
Yes, and most of those situations were, you know, people that were too close to the freeway, and they'd seen too many people. And the welcome had been worn out.
Okay, all right. And now, Father Michael, a strong character in the book. He is strong in his faith, of course, but he's not afraid to take a life to save a life.
Yes, and but he doesn't want to get put in that situation again. He shows up and he's able to explain things in ways that people need to have it heard.
And people go to him; they have issues, and they need comfort, and he's the person to hopefully calm them down. Now, of course, rumors abound with all this going on. There's no real information. It's spotty. And we have news of an event in Philadelphia. A lot of the nation's leaders are, well, affected by this event.
Yes. And that is where the virus is released as a bioweapon. So there's concern that some of our nation's leaders have been lost to that.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the conspiracy involved. Now, who's running the show?
Right.
Yes. Who is running the show?
That becomes the question.
Who are we? And that's where the National Guard comes in. They don't really know who their allegiance is to.
Right. And through the story, I don't really reveal that. It's just what the people in my story find out from the radio and things like that. I'm not the narrator doesn't reveal all that information. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's part of the appeal of this novel. You really don't know what's going on, and people are kind of left in the dark in this cold winter. Now, I found some Lord of the Flies moments where the strong are preying on the weak, and that was kind of scary.
Yes. And I try not to dwell on those situations, but I bring in some stories here and there of what people have had to go through.
And hints of cannibalism as the food runs out. Wow. Winston Churchill, you mentioned him in the book. He wrote, "The first casualty in any war is the truth." So what is the truth during this cold winter? and our band of patriots is trying to find out, but at what cost? And that leads us to Book 3, where LST 325 is rearmed for battle, along with an old Huey helicopter. Now, who has the helicopter?
Oh, Dominic has the helicopter, and he's introduced as a person who flew with the National Guard for the Katrina emergency.
Mm-hmm. And is Kirksey familiar with Huey helicopters? His sidekick?
Yes, he is his co-pilot.
Okay. And understand you had a chance to actually ride aboard a Huey helicopter.
Yes, I went to the Dayton Air Show, to where a Huey helicopter group was giving rides, and eventually I just ended up staying there the whole day and talking with the pilots, and then they invited me to join their group and come and volunteer with them on their next show, just to help out. And, you know, setting up their tents and setting up tables, things like that. And I was able to be around them quite a bit and learn a little bit from them of some really great stories, especially since when you think about a Huey helicopter, it's mainly in a dense forest and things like that. So my story is in the winter, and so I found a helicopter pilot who had served in Alaska. So,
oh, boy. Yeah.
So I had some really great stories.
Mm-hmm. Now, coming up, more of my conversation with author Chris Underwood as the crew of LST 325 fights back on their mission to rescue a good guy, the vice president, and prevent the Great Lakes Purchase. We'll talk about that, a U.S. government deal to sell the heartland to the Chinese. A lot going on here. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back with more of the cold winter. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Chris Underwood. He's the author of the Cold Winter book series, 3 books, taking the reader on a frightening journey when the power grid is down in the Great Lakes area and neighbors have to band together to survive not only the cold winter, but a government takeover. And besides all the chaos facing our characters, and we talked about this mysterious illness, maybe fostered by a foreign power. We talked about its similarities maybe to COVID-19. And, of course, folks are suspicious of the vaccine, which is being offered to these people during the cold winter.
That's right. Yeah, it is strangely reminiscent.
It is. Now, let's go back aboard the LST 325, leaving port in Evansville, headed upriver on this secret mission. And who's the captain?
So the captain is a character that I have just built on my own. That he is somewhat like Captain Jordan.
Jordan, yeah.
Yeah, Jordan. That
now he was this captain in your book comes from Memphis, right?
Right.
And he's, I guess, he's also involved in the kind of the militia movement. Is that correct?
Yes. But he's kind of fighting back about it. He's more there just to protect his ship.
Oh, that's right. He's very protective of the warship.
That's right. And so he's wanting to make sure that that the ship is not destroyed in this whole thing, and is not really believing it in this whole mission altogether.
Of course, Evansville, the shipyard here, built 167 LSTs during World War II. The shipyard had like as many as 19,000 workers at one time. It was a city along the Ohio River, cranking out these ships built to haul cargo in World War II. And of course, these ships were very important. And of course, the landing operations we had to have, and of course, in the specific theater as well, LSTs were very important. And they had to be armed, didn't they?
Yes.
Crossing the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans. What kind of armament did they have?
Well, they had the 20mm and the 40s. I mean, currently, of course, now the weapons are not operational. But in my story, the equipment necessary to rearm them was brought on board.
Mm-hmm. And now the ships are heading upriver, and of course, anytime you go upriver, you have to pass through locks and dams, and that's where the ship is most vulnerable because for a time it's literally dead in the water.
That's right. And also the locks have been taken over by the enemy. Mm-hmm. So they need to be liberated. They need to be cleared.
How long does it take in that docking process?
It was at least an hour.
Really?
Each time, yes.
Each time you went through those on your cruise.
Right, yes. And we would, when we were going down through to Marietta, we had to stay in the lock for a couple of hours just because it was so foggy. It was difficult to get through.
So if somebody was going to attack the ship, that's a good place to attack it.
That's right. Okay. Yes. So we needed to make sure we were secure there.
So they make it through the Newburgh locks and dam. No real problems there?
Not too much.
Okay.
But they have there is a battle there.
Yeah, because we have the guys on board have compatriots on the land.
That's right.
Who are helping them on their journey.
Yes, there are bands, right? Yes, there are militant groups. There are the Minutemen that are stationed along the Ohio River.
And that's funny that they call them and they show up.
That's right.
And do their deed.
Yes.
And clear the dam. Yes. Okay. Now they go from Newburgh and that. Not too eventful there, but they get through there. Then they go to the Canelton Locks and Dam. And that was a little bit tougher assignment because there are some snipers, right, up in the hills.
Yes, up at the Eagle's Bluff.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the actual terrain that is there for the storyline. And it kind of works out that it's kind of realistic, actually.
Mm-hmm. And they use this... Trojan horse maneuver. Barges and towboats were going up and down the river anyway, doing their normal commerce, and so they got a chance to utilize one of these river vehicles to help them out.
That's right. They use one of the barges to go in as a Trojan horse, and they arm it and they're able to take the lock that way.
Now you did a lot of research. On this book, River Research, and of course you're kind of a nautical guy anyway, they go up to Leavenworth. There's a place there called Devil's Bend. Tell me about Devil's Bend.
Yeah, I researched a lot of the nautical stuff about the river itself and finding that, that the Devil's Bend, and since there's so much, there is a little bit of faith being thrown around in the story, being able to bring up that fact was a cool thing.
Well, tell me about your faith.
Oh,
I know it comes up in the book.
It does. Yeah, I was raised Southern Baptist, with the person screaming hallelujah from the back row and things like that. And I married into a Catholic family, and eventually, like 18 years into the marriage, I converted to Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And it felt like the thing to do, and I didn't even let my family know about it until that I was going to the classes and for the conversion until halfway through.
Now, faith keeps these people going, a lot of the people.
It does. It does.
Because everything is going wrong.
Right. It's a lot of faith and a lot of trust, trust mm-hmm. in each other and things like that.
Now, we talked about the other Patriots, not the ones on board of the ship, but there were some aboard the Huey helicopter, a relic of another war. And tell me about the Jesus nut. Okay, I love that reference.
Yes, it's the nut on the top of the propeller that holds it down, holds it onto the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what was the reference that said that if it's not there, then they'll look like Wile E. Coyote coming off of the of a cliff. I get into the point of them doing a 100-hour maintenance on that helicopter, which was something that I experienced when I was touring with the Huey group. So mm-hmm. it was just something that I try to bring in all the experiences that I've had.
So that was one of their points, that to make sure that thing was on time,
yes.
Right?
Okay. Make sure it's on. Okay. Always check it.
Yeah. Were you influenced by any other writers in putting together this series?
I would say that, my main influence, my earliest influence was Ian Fleming. I was a huge fan of the of Ian Fleming. But Clive Cussler has really come out in my storylines here, especially since his stories mainly start small and then they build into something very, very grand. And that's kind of what I'm doing here as well. I'm taking it to a very grand we're talking about the vice president here in the story and things like that, but it started very small.
Right. Now, how do you develop a character? Do you have like a board or something and you put things up there? Or?
Oh, I really haven't done it that way. I really have. Well, the characters kind of develop themselves in the end.
And a lot of the characters are people you know.
Yes, they are. They are. Like the character Ed is a friend of mine from church, actually. It's funny that one time my wife and I were going, we're going to go sit at church at a pew, and I said, let's go up there and sit next to Ed. And she said, Ed who? I changed his name. But whatever.
And there's another character who has a large kind of a barn, I guess, with all kinds of equipment in there. Definitely a interesting character. And that's you, right?
Yes, that's me. I own some storage facilities here. So I did have a lot of motorhomes and things like that stored in there.
And they would use the gasoline. Mm-hmm. That was very important to conserve the gasoline.
Right.
And any food that might be left over.
Yes, left over in those campers and things like that. But yes, I have I also have a friend that his prepper plan is to go to his camper, and that's where he would his bug out place.
So he would go off the grid in his camper,
right?
And survive. Okay,
that's
good.
Where that idea came from. Yeah.
Okay, we're talking about the battle on the Ohio as they make their way north to this rendezvous to rescue the vice president. That's a good scene. Now, the war on the river rages on. Still drama back on the home front in rural Ohio. Folks still dealing with shortages and the threats from these walkers. There's a scene where a doctor tackles a surgery on a kitchen table. Tell me about that. Was it a tonsillectomy type thing?
Yeah, it's a tonsillectomy sort of operation. And actually, I have a good friend who
of course you do.
Who is an ear, neck, and throat surgeon. And so he came into the story. And actually, I had a great phone conversation with him about how this procedure is done and all of that sort of thing. What kind of equipment you would need to have and how you could adapt it with limited technology. And
yeah, he wasn't
like
in an operating room, was
That's
he?
That's right. Yeah, it's just okay. On a kitchen table. Yeah,
and a young girl was she was, I guess, near death, wasn't she?
Right.
In the
right.
book. Boy, okay. Now. What is HARP? I know HARP's mentioned in the story.
Yes, HARP is something that's been in the news an awful lot lately, as a matter of fact. It is a conspiracy theory story that the government is able to control the weather by using microwaves broadcast into the sky. And whether it can be done or not, it's a conspiracy theory, but I bring it up in my story without any conclusion to it, but it's thrown around a little bit.
Yeah, that you can actually either divert a storm or something, or create a storm, right?
Right.
That's the
theory. Yeah, the theory of it is that you can make a storm more intense, not necessarily create a storm, but you could take a storm that's already there and make it more intense and maybe direct it.
Wow. As a weapon.
As a weapon, yes.
Okay. Now, the Great Lakes Purchase, this comes up in the book, and explain that.
this is another one of my fantastical things of my storyline, but it seems to make sense how I explain it throughout the story, and it's that a portion of the country is being given to China to appease them. And And so it's a different kind of storyline.
Well, China's kind of calling in their debts, aren't they?
Yeah, they're calling in their debts. They're saying that, well, you know, we already own 20% of this farmland anyway. This is kind of like a corporate takeover.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, once these patriots learn about that, that's bad news. They don't like that at all.
They don't want that to happen at all.
Now, the National Guard plays a role in this. And these are like people, citizens, soldiers. They know some of the people that are involved in the struggles of the cold winter. And they're kind of torn between their allegiances.
Right, whether to follow orders or follow their conscience.
Yeah, and there's a confrontation with Dominic.
Yes.
And a bridge, and that kind of goes in different directions.
Yeah, it goes sideways there.
It does. Yeah, we have a Bridge of the River Kwai moment there.
Yeah, yeah, it kind of brings in some old storylines.
Yeah,
but it works. It works out.
I think it does. It does. And now we won't give away the conclusion, but there is of course a final battle scene, and a TV crew is pressed into action to kind of deliver a message, and. This is not the TV crew you would think would do that. This was a ESPN crew, right?
Right. They just happened to be in Greensboro for March Madness, and they're called in to help out with getting a message out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting. A lot of this action is just confined to the Great Lakes area. The rest of the country seems to be going on as normal.
They still have power. They still have power.
They have the daily routine. They're doing okay.
Right. There's still some riots here and there and things like that. And there's some control being forced, but help is sporadic in the disaster area.
Now there may be a book 4. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. I've begun working on it a little bit. The whole ideas are beginning to fester.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I put it. They fester in my head for a while. But the whole story has been based around the Niagara Falls power grid, and so the next one will be the Battle of the Niagara Falls.
Okay, all right. Now you on this book tour. I mean, you make a lot of stops at different events and festivals and book fairs. And what's the feedback from the readers?
I've gotten some really great feedback. I really have. And also mainly some from people who are not necessarily readers of this genre. You know, just because it is a character-based story, and it doesn't necessarily have to be just a survival kind of book, and it kind of draws you in for the people.
Would you consider yourself a prepper?
Yes, somewhat. I mean, I don't have a bunker in the backyard,
but I
have prepared some.
The 5 F's for survival.
Yes.
There you go.
And
got your firewood?
Got the firewood. I do have, and I've been accumulating first aid. I have a lot of people in my family are in the nursing field and things like that. So I have accumulated quite a store and food and things like that, and it's also about bringing together the friends.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tony, in the book, the wife of Tom, she's in the medical profession, isn't she?
Yes, she's a radiation therapist.
Okay, so she, her skills come in handy during the book as well. Now, you have donated some of your book proceeds to the LST 325 Memorial.
Yes, just last week I gave them a check for $1,000, and it was really great to be able to give back.
So what's the importance of having this ship operational and going on these tours? What do you think?
I think it's been a great thing to be able to show what the ship is able to do and what it is for people to be able to walk through and be able to see how the folks lived and worked on the ship. I think it's a great thing for especially younger folks to
see
it. Yes.
Yeah. What surprised you when you went on board the ship for the first time?
Oh, well, just all the interest that the folks had.
I mean, personally, what did you find on the ship that was fascinating?
Oh, yeah. Well, the control tower, you know,
the pilot house,
the pilot house, mm-hmm. all of that. And also the newer equipment that have been added to it also to help in the current day. But the way that they had to have run it before is crazy. You know, the engine room was really the person who was controlling the speed of the ship. And they would just speak down through the telecom to tell them what it needed to be. The person up there that was a pilot didn't really have, you know, the joystick or anything else to control things. He was just telling other people what to do.
Now, that engine room, very claustrophobic when you get down in there.
Oh, man.
And can you imagine in the South Pacific how hot that would be down there?
Oh, my.
Unbelievable.
Yes, yes. And I was in there.
Oh.
I did a shift. My shift was, it was midnight to 4.
Oh, boy.
It was a difficult shift. And it's very loud.
Sure.
And you're checking
the gauges and making sure everything's, I guess, lubricated and
yes.
running smoothly.
Yes.
Did you run into any problems on this trip?
No
really?
Problems at all.
Good.
It all ran well. And just watching the starting procedure, how they start the engines, things like that. That was interesting as well.
Some of the characters you met on board.
Yes. Yes. It was interesting. The amount of people that had worked on the river that ran barges and things like that. And were serving aboard the ship.
Now, I thought it was interesting when I was on board the ship for a 3-day cruise, where you go past these little towns and people would be on the bank waving at you and everything.
Yeah.
That was so cool.
Yes, that was really neat. That was really neat. Just to see the people coming out.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And one time we went past, we were near Fort Knox, and the Army guys had some boats out there doing maneuvers. And the captain, you know, they usually play the anchors away, but they were playing the caissons for the Army guys, and they were all waving and everything. They enjoyed that. So, I mean, it's a floating billboard, really, for Evansville, Indiana. And we're so lucky to have that ship here. And they continue to do the maintenance on it, and it is ship shape.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This winter, they took it down to Texas and put it
the
in
dry dock.
In dry dock, yeah. Pull it out of the water and repainted the whole underneath and everything. It was, they've done extensive work on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you had any other novels besides the Cold Winter series?
Actually, I do. I have a murder mystery that I've written called The Creatures of Holden Beach and the Murder They Did Not Commit.
Is there actually that beach somewhere?
There is. It's in North Carolina. It's near Myrtle Beach. And my storyline is that someone has created a lifelike looking alien with cameras inside of it, and they leave it on the beach for people to find it, trying to catch the reactions and go viral on the internet with it. But the whole plan gets messed up because there was a murder on the beach the night before.
Oh,
and so it's kind of it's almost like an episode of Columbo, where you've got the serious mystery and you've got the funny mystery mm-hmm. that the sheriff is trying to solve, and they both of them come together in the end.
Well, who's the protagonist in this novel?
It's mainly you got the sheriff, and then you've also got the hometown starlet who finds she's home from Hollywood, and she's one of the ones who finds the creature on the beach.
Okay, now your family, have they read the series?
My son has. Okay. My wife is not a reader, so mm-hmm. she hasn't, but she's a very supportive person for what I'm doing.
Now, the folks in Galena, Ohio, what do they think of the book?
Oh, they just love it. They love this hometown story, and they also like that it brings out all the area and landmarks of the area.
I know you mentioned a lot of those crossroads, and they identify with them.
Yes, yes.
And they probably identify some of the characters who, that's so-and-so.
Yeah.
That's got to be so-and-so.
Yes, okay. Yes, yeah. I bring up the mayor of Galena, and they say, I know who that is. Yeah.
Now, if someone has not been aboard LST 325, what's going to be their impression when they are welcomed aboard? Are they going to go back in history?
I believe that they will. And I think most people have said just the size of the tank bay is very surprising to them, because it is a very large space. And I think everything about it, just how it is built and all the little details that are made for it.
And the fact that it's history, where that ship has been, mm-hmm. what it's been through, the people who have come on board. I mean, they transported wounded people and prisoners and all the equipment. It's just an incredible story. And it was attacked a couple of times, too.
Yes. They have marked where bullet holes mm-hmm. have happened in the decks and things like that. Yeah,
okay.
That's cool.
Well, Chris Underwood, this is a great read, the Cold Winter series. It's set in our own backyard featuring LST 325. Congratulations on the book series. And we're looking forward now to book number 4.
Yes.
Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.
Two key figures in the LST 325 story died this year, Mike Wicker and Robert Jornlin. Mike was one of the early supporters of bringing the World War II vessel to Evansville. And Robert Jornlin was a Navy veteran who sailed the ship from Greece to Mobile, Alabama in 2001. He spearheaded its restoration and was captain of the vessel as it returned to service as a floating museum. Along with the Cold Winter book series by Chris Underwood, LST 325 is getting national and international attention. Spokesman Chris Donahue says crews from the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, and the Smithsonian Channel have featured the ship in past shows. Woodcut Productions from London featured LST 325 in its combat ship series, and a film crew from Bloomington, Indiana came aboard for the 2021 movie Runner. And an LST 325 LCVP, Landing Craft Vehicles and Personnel, also known as a Higgins boat, was used in the Clint Eastwood movie Flags of Our Fathers. To Main Street on WNIN-FM airs Thursday at noon and Saturday at 11. And previous shows are online at WNIN.org.